message from the Media Foundation.
Welcome back, listeners. This is Fane of the Cosmos.
Fane of the Awful Ass.
Whoa, buddy. This is an article from the Winnipeg Free Press. Pot, tobacco, chemicals found in raid of rural home. A 28-year-old Kelwood, Manitoba man has been accused of growing illegal cigarette tobacco and operating an indoor hydroponic marijuana garden, RCMP said yesterday. Staff Sergeant Jean Cormier said even more convincing is that officers who raided the home found chemicals that could have been used to make methamphetamine, a highly addictive street drug. Cormier said officers with the Westlake RCMP detachment, the Brandon RCMP Customs and Excise Section, the Winnipeg RCMP Drug Section, the RCMP Drug Section's Clandestine Laboratory Section, and members of the Manitoba Fire Commissioner's Office participated in the raid and seizures. Kelwood is about 5 kilometers outside the eastern edge of Riding Mountain National Park on Highway 5, about 20 kilometers south of McCreary. Cormier said investigators seized more than 30 kilograms of drying tobacco hanging from the rafters of a shed. The tobacco had been grown outside last year. Police have no evidence the man was selling it, he said. Cormier said by law, individuals are allowed to possess no more than 15 kilograms of homegrown tobacco for personal use. He added customs and excise investigators are still finishing their report, so the suspect has not yet been officially charged with any tobacco-related offenses. Ryan Steve Tarek has been charged with production of cannabis marijuana, production of cannabis resin, and production of cannabis resin for the purpose of trafficking. Wait a second. Production of cannabis resin for the purpose of trafficking. I don't think that's even a charge. But you never know, they're making up stuff. So listeners, we have our first tobacco bust. I can't believe it. Can you imagine? Someone was growing tobacco, they had it hanging in their house, and they get busted. But what's even more heinous, did you hear how many sections of the Manitoba justice system were involved on the raid? Like, for some pot and some tobacco? Like, you're next, buddy. Anybody out there who wants to grow some long bottom leaf in their own backyard, you're in trouble. Also, the chemicals they say could be used in the manufacture of methamphetamine could be something as simple as...
Yeah. Could be cough syrup.
It could be cough syrup. He might have had a bottle of NyQuil in his, or cough syrup, you know, in his medicine cabinet, and that could be proof of methamphetamine production.
You know, in fact, I think it's probably likely that it was just cough syrup, because when they start nailing somebody for stuff like a bit of tobacco for personal use, then you know that they're really just trying to hit this guy with everything that they got.
Yeah.
So chances are it was just cough syrup, and it's just another big hyped up drug war bullshit thing.
But I didn't know that. So if you're out there and you've grown quite a bit, like 15 kilograms of tobacco, just so a listener knows, like 35 pounds of tobacco. It's kind of unusual. But can you imagine getting busted for, how would they do that? You know, possession of tobacco for the purpose of smoking. You know?
I guess there's a law, obviously, right?
Yeah, but...
You're only allowed to have 15 kilograms, no more.
That's so ridiculous, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so are pot laws. So are all stupid laws.
Okay, what about this? Home-brewed beer. Nelson man was found with 16 cases of beer, home-brewed beer. You know, like the Nelson City Police, the Nelson RCMP, the Border Integrity Unit, the Fire Chief, the Fire Chief's wife, the hockey team, the curling club were all involved in the raid. Also found were a pair of scissors. You know, like, it just gets to be too much, Dan. I can't handle it no more, brother.
Oh, I know how you feel.
So, we're going to go to another little song here. Or just, how about a little snippety snippet? Here we go.
Man, I see in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential.
Look, the people you are after are the people you depend on. We cook your meals. We haul your trash. We connect your calls. We drive your ambulances. We guard you while you sleep. Do not fuck with us.
Yeah. So, Dan, you got a news item?
Well, I don't particularly have a news item. I have another long-winded kind of, you know,
okay, well, research item. I have another news item.
Why don't you do a news item?
Okay. From the Fane of the Cosmos News Center, with association of Homo Divinus News Source, no, the Homo Divinus Free Press. This is about the Pope. You know about that, don't you?
I guess so. Yeah, sure, I know about the Pope.
Do you know the Pope smokes dope?
I know that the Pope hates dope.
Uh-oh. Controversy is brewing in the studio, folks. This is an article called Holy Smoke. The exclamation, Holy Smoke, derives from the burning of ballots used to elect a Pope. Status? False. With the current hubbub surrounding the election of a new pope, I was wondering if the phrase holy smoke came from the smoke used in the burning of ballots during the conclave. Origins. As crowds watched the plumes of white smoke that announced the election of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger as Pope Benedict something or other, some were moved to ask themselves if the signal wasn't in fact the holy smoke of popular terminology. Did the one have something to do with the other, or were they related? Smoke. Though the wispy beacon rising from the Sistine Chapel was both holy and smoke, this ancient mode of announcing a new pope isn't the source of the idiom. The Oxford English Dictionary records the earliest print sighting of holy smoke as found in the Epiphany, a 1627 poem by Sir J. Beaumont, who, quote, who lift to God for verse the holy smoke of fervent prayers. For those... Here, I'm reading Old English. I'm like, what the hell? It says, who lift to God for us the holy smoke of fervent prayers. In that 1627 work, the phrase is used as a picturesque way of describing the burning of incense. It is not until 1892, however, that it is recorded as finding employment as an exclamation or mild expletive, that is, as saying something wholly divorced of anything literally to do with this, with something being burned or the smoke it would give off. In that year, Rudyard Kipling and his American agent Charles Balestier used it as an independent venomance in the Nalaka. By the holy smoke, someone has got to urge girls to stand by the old machine. From that point forward, holy smoke began appearing in the literature of the day as a generic exclamation. The two uses may have arisen independently and so be unrelated. The practice of setting fire to gifts meant for the gods is an ancient one, because deities are presumed to inhabit the heavens above and smoke rises. The connection was made that burning items designated as religious offerings would result in these ablutions being transported to their intended recipients. Animals and foodstuffs were thus sacrificed in this fashion, and incense burnt for the same reason. In an attempt at pyro-assisted rush delivery, those who needed particular interventions on the quick would oftentimes write out their prayers, then ceremonially burn the inscribed bits of paper so as to speed their supplications heavenward. The divergence theory is supported by a number of other holy exclamations in existence, such as Holy Moses, or Holy Cow, or Holy Shit. These sayings are not inserted into conversation for their literal meanings, but as ways of punctuating surrounding statements or situations in general. Example, Holy Moses, did you see the look she gave me? I'm reading from the article. Holy cow, I'm going to be late. Look beyond just the exclamations and examining the broader scope of the two-part holy terms. One quickly sees that a great many use as their completers words that have a strong O presence. Holy Joe. Holy moly. Holy Toledo. Holy horror. Holy roller. As well as the previously mentioned Holy Moses and Holy Cow. Holy smoke fits this alliterativeness. This joy-filled pursuit of the rolling O. Barbara in the Ozone Mickelson. So, there we go. Holy smoke is not referring to the cannabis smoke that is coming up when they decide the Pope. It is actually a different thing from Rudyard Kipling.
I still think it's witches are burning. So, hey, Dustin. The Pope hates dope. Well, we have a great article here by Daniel Larson on the Cannabis Culture website called The Pope Hates Dope. And he did a little research, and, well, he looks like he did quite a bit of research. And he wrote an article about the Pope, and it's interesting that Pope John Paul II did at some point come out against marijuana decriminalization. He on a few occasions apparently said that there was no difference between hard and soft drugs. In 1997, he issued a statement that said that legalizing drugs would be akin to legalizing murder, and also called for the banning of tobacco. These statements were actually part of the church's long-standing policy of official hatred for marijuana, as Dana puts it. And this can all be traced back to the witch hunts, and many of you may remember me talking about the crusades against the witches in the medieval times. And and back then, the Catholic Church would actually, if they found cannabis on you, that was a sign that you were a witch, and it was basically evidence could be used against you in a witch trial, so that you might be burned. Dana adds to that magic mushrooms that in fact the Manichaeans, who are magic mushroom eaters, were also slaughtered by Catholic armies in the 12th century. And it's interesting that we have this long-standing war against pot, beginning essentially with the Inquisition. But what's even more interesting to me is that the new Pope, Cardinal Ratzinger, his official title before he was made Pope, I believe it was something like Guardian of the Dogma. And previously, up to about 40 years ago, that title was Grand Inquisitor. So, in fact, Cardinal Ratzinger, who's now the Pope, was previously the leader of an institution that at one time persecuted and killed millions of people, and sometimes for cannabis use. So you can see that, and essentially now I think he's the, that particular office could probably be likened unto the church's secret service. But, there's a kind of a statement, I think, being made in the election of this person that that the church doesn't intend to become less conservative, especially in its views on marijuana.
Fundamentalism is on the rise from here to eternity.
So that's our thing on popes and dope.
Okay, Dustin. We're going to go to a song. This is Tom Petty.
Girl on marijuana. She said, if I'm not stoned, I don't wanna. But she got so paranoid, her place I would avoid. I was in love with a girl on marijuana. I was in love with a girl on cocaine. She had everything going but her brain. We'd talk endlessly for hours, but by morning it'd go sour. I was in love with a girl on cocaine. Through ecstasy, crystal meth and glue, I found no drug compares to you. All these pills, all this weed, I don't know just what I need. I was in love with a girl on LSD. She'd see things I'd never see. She broadened her perspective. Then I got more selective. I was in love with a girl on LSD. Through ecstasy, crystal meth and glue, I found no drug compares to you. All these pills, all this weed, I don't know what I need. I was in love with a girl who drank beer till bad breath and all, she disappeared. She was blowing up real bad, but when she left I was still sad. I was in love with a girl who drank beer. I was in love with a girl on China Way. We were married for a year one night. Her memory still lingers, 'cause I burned all my fingers. I was in love with a girl on China Way. Love with a girl who drank coffee. There's times when I couldn't keep her off me. That caffeine got her going, but her ugly side was showing. I was in love with a girl who drank coffee. I was in love with a girl who was a dealer. I was afraid somebody'd come and steal her. We never used to fight, but the phone rang day and night. I was in love with a girl who was a dealer.
Sure as hell, she got popped by the big guys.
July is National Baked Bean Month. Excuse me. Yes, a month in which we pay tribute to one of America's favorite, most healthful, and nutritious foods. I'm terribly sorry. As I was saying, good Lord, this is terribly embarrassing. I'm so...
Whoa, doggy! I guess I'd better wrap this up quick. Basically, Jesus! Whoa! Oh, God! My God!
Baked beans. They're nature's way of saying, for God's sake, open a window. Sorry.
This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of April 28th, 2005.
All right, police! Police!
Bad Cop No Donut!
Bad, 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 bad.
Cop, 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 cop.
No, 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 no. Donut, 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 donut.
Because I'm the law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. A police officer in Albion, New York, was sentenced this week to between 1 1/3 and 3 years in prison after he admitted to a court that he tried to sexually assault two women while he was on duty and in uniform. According to the Associated Press, Officer Joseph Santoro told a court that in September 2002, he tried to force a woman to perform oral sex. He also admitted to fondling the mother of a troubled youth who he had asked to come to a police station. He then threatened the woman with retaliation if she told anyone about the incident. He was later charged with first-degree attempted sexual abuse and official misconduct. A New York City police officer was arrested last Thursday after he found his girlfriend with another man and then assaulted the man with a frying pan. An article in the New York Daily News says that Officer James Kim has been charged with second-degree assault and has been suspended. A group of senior police officers and detectives in New York City who were supposed to be preventing corruption are now facing misconduct charges of their own. According to the New York Post, the 13 comprised virtually the entire unit assigned to monitor narcotics, vice, and firearms officers in the department's organized crime bureau. The 13 officers are facing a variety of charges, including failing to supervise, misuse of time, and creating their work schedules around their personal lives. They are also charged with irregularities regarding overtime hours, which is one of the abuses they were supposed to be monitoring their fellow officers for. All but one of the officers in the unit have been replaced. Another police officer in New York City has pleaded guilty to second-degree manslaughter after he says he accidentally shot an 18-year-old deli clerk, killing him. According to the Associated Press, the officer, John Malik, described the incident as tragic horseplay. An indictment accused Malik of recklessly firing his gun at the victim while cashing a lottery ticket at the deli. Malik faces between 1 and 3 years in jail when he is sentenced on June 14th. A police officer in Albany, New York, who was accused of leading a shoplifting ring, has been sentenced this week to serve 60 days in a diversion center. WALB says that prosecutors accused Officer Melissa Albritton of shoplifting while in uniform and assisting others in stealing from Albany area stores. She was allowed to plead guilty to one count of violation of oath of office. Although the officer will not serve any prison time, Albritton will be serving 5 years of probation, has been fined $500, and her police certification has been revoked. Another police officer in Albany, New York, was charged with impaired driving last week. WNYT reports that Officer Richard Shunk was arrested after the car he was driving collided with a parked vehicle at 4:30 in the morning last Friday. Police who responded to the accident noted that Shunk had slurred speech and smelled of alcohol and arrested him after he refused to take a breathalyzer test. The officer suffered minor injuries in the accident and has been suspended from the Albany Police Department pending the completion of their investigation. Yet another Albany, New York police officer is accused of beating a 14-year-old girl who was among a crowd of students watching a schoolyard fight earlier this month. According to a WTEN report, the girl, who was an honors student, was the only person at the school that day who needed to be rushed to hospital. Although she was not involved in the fight, she was, nonetheless, beaten by an unnamed officer and will require surgery to replace a shattered bone in her face with a metal plate. A lawyer representing the girl's family said this week that he plans to file a lawsuit. A police officer in Westwood, Massachusetts, is facing accusations from city officials that he stole drugs, threatened people, illegally searched homes and cars, and offered people favors in exchange for drugs. An article in the Daily News Tribune says that the allegations were made in a 12-page report from a retired Superior Court judge who found what he called credible evidence that Officer Kevin McCarthy was guilty of a number of violations. According to the report, the officer stole OxyContin from the home of an elderly man while on a medical call, offered to let a teenager off of a traffic violation in exchange for drugs, conducted several illegal searches, taking drugs during traffic stops, and failing to turn them in as evidence, and stealing drugs from a police evidence locker. So far, McCarthy has not been charged with a crime. A police officer in Howard County, Maryland, has been arrested for running an illegal gambling operation in a local warehouse. The Baltimore Sun reports that the police raided the building on April 12th, and this week charged Officer Michael Thorne with 8 misdemeanors. Police seized poker chips, professional card tables, and $6,500 in cash during the raid. Thorne is also accused of running a similar operation in Baltimore County. Playing cards for money is illegal in Maryland. A man in Pritchard, Alabama, was arrested 2 days after filing a complaint against the police department. An account in the Mobile Register says police claim that they did not arrest the man at the time of the incident he complained about on March 22nd, because the man was hospitalized. The man's lawyer points out that the man was released from hospital 8 days later and has serious concerns about the timing of the arrest. The man is seeking $25 million in damages after he was allegedly beaten by several officers, one of whom has been placed on administrative leave while the case is reviewed. The man claims he was beaten by police who decided to question him after he purchased a package of cigarettes from a convenience store. This week, the man was charged with loitering, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest. None of the officers involved have been named.
I have blocked a lot of that out, so I'm seeing it. I can't believe it happened.
She's absolutely manhandled and slammed to the ground for no reason, or certainly no valid reason that I can see.
I was begging them right there, begging them to let me sit up. I didn't want my mom to see me that way. God.
A police officer in Atlanta, Georgia, who was accused of using excessive force against a woman who was dropping off her mother at an airport in an incident last November, may be fired from his job. According to an Associated Press report, an investigation found that Officer Terrence Alexander had violated department policy when he threw the woman to the pavement in an effort to arrest her for a traffic violation. He charged the woman with illegal parking, battery, and obstruction, but those charges were dropped after his superiors reviewed a videotape of the incident. Alexander has been notified that he will be fired on May 9th. A sheriff's deputy in Chattooga County, Georgia, who is on the local drug task force, was arrested last week. A report from WTVC says that Deputy Mike Davis has been charged with 12 different felonies, most concerning mishandling of drug informant money, but including one charge of an inappropriate sexual contact with a woman who was in his custody. Davis has been placed on paid leave, but an upcoming internal hearing may result in his termination. He's currently free on bail, but faces up to 5 years on 11 of the 12 charges, and up to 15 years for the charge of theft. A police officer in Houston, Texas, was arrested while on duty last week during a sting. KPRC is reporting that Officer Tyrone Cross was arrested last Sunday while he was on duty and charged with soliciting a prostitute earlier in his shift. He is charged with one misdemeanor count of prostitution and is free after posting a $1,000 bond. Cross has been suspended with pay. Houston police are not saying what led to their investigation of the officer. A former Houston, Texas police officer accused of raping two women, including a teenager, and the subject of an investigation into the rape of another teenager, may have altered the electronic monitoring equipment used to make sure he was at his home. KTRK says that Ronnie Jackson was arrested on March 17th and charged with sexual assault and aggravated kidnapping after he was accused of picking up a woman and raping her in February. He was already facing another sexual assault charge for the alleged 2004 rape of a 15-year-old girl. Another alleged sexual assault, this time a 14-year-old, is alleged to have taken place in March 2005 when Jackson was supposedly at home and being monitored by an ankle bracelet. Police now believe that Jackson somehow modified the monitoring device to show that he was at home when he was not.
I thought somebody was stealing, and when I got up on the person, it was the police. I seen the gun like this right here, and he told me to put my hands up, and I was terrified because I thought maybe he was going to shoot me. He told me to get down on my knees, and as I was attempting to get down on my knees, he kicked me and broke my ankle and just started kicking me.
That wasn't right.
Something just don't add up. And to me, it's totally a case of police brutality.
A man in Cherokee County, Texas, claims he was beaten by an officer when he went to investigate a noise outside of his home. A Morning Telegraph report says that the man was asked by his father to go outside and see what the dogs were barking at when he was assaulted by Deputy Jamie Bean, who he found outside with a flashlight. The man suffered a broken ankle and other injuries in the attack, which the victim claims took place after he was already in handcuffs. The man was arrested for interfering in a police investigation. Several witnesses to the beating say they saw the deputy kicking and beating the victim and also say that medical assistance was not called for the man until after officers from another jurisdiction arrived. Deputy Bean is still on duty. A police officer in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who applied to be the chief of police last year, has been accused of using multiple identities to buy prescription painkillers on the internet. According to an Associated Press report, Corporal Robert Ducklow was an internal affairs investigator until he was arrested this week by local and federal investigators and charged with obtaining a controlled substance by fraud and possession of a Schedule III drug. Ducklow, who resigned from his job after his arrest, had reportedly become addicted to prescription painkillers after a recent injury. A police officer in Las Cruces, New Mexico, was arrested last week after being accused of making inappropriate sexual advances on a woman who he had pulled over in a traffic stop. An Associated Press story says that Officer Anthony Coble has been charged with demanding or receiving a bribe and tampering with public records. Coble resigned from his job on March 30th, 2 days after the traffic stop, when he allegedly made an advance toward the woman, had her follow him to a nearby fire station, and then destroyed several traffic citations in her presence. A police officer in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who had a complaint against him upheld earlier this month, had been in trouble in the past and has since been forced to resign from the force. According to the Albuquerque Journal, the local police oversight commission upheld the unprofessional conduct complaint in part because of Officer Corey Wadley's prior complaint history. Since 2003, the officer has had 8 citizen complaints and 3 tort claims filed against him. 2 weeks ago, Wadley resigned from his job over a separate internal affairs investigation. In addition to the allegation of unprofessional conduct, other complaints against Wadley included false arrest and unreasonable use of force. A police officer.
Welcome back. This is Fan of the Cosmos. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio 93.5 FM, CGLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicooperadio.com and Kootenai Lake on 96.5 FM. The radio show is available for download from www.radio4all.net. We have archive shows there that can be downloaded at your convenience.
That was pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, Bad Cop No Donut is never light, let me tell you.
I know, and we always try to keep this show light, a little bit anyways.
Well,
you know, there's lots of, like, you know, dark stuff. You want
to... The truth has to get out there, and one day, I think, on the radio show, probably in the next few months, we should interview Ron Anisich.
Yeah, that'd be good. Didn't we interview him already, though?
No.
The Bad Cop No Donut?
No.
I thought we did.
No.
Oh, okay.
He did email. We had a little email scrum there.
Dustin, you're looking a little bloated, brother.
Look, this show is brought to you by Dan's Gas.
I don't know. You're looking a little red, man. Looks like... Dustin, get your ass out of my... Oh, Dustin!
Whatever.
That's so gross, buddy.
Okay, it's one small group per man. One giant...
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Oh my god.
Nice one, buddy. That one put you on the moon.
Vegetarians, beware.
Yeah, that last one was the coup d'etat. But let's see here.
Okay, let's try and keep it serious, Dan.
Dustin, can you Oh man, okay.
You may think it's funny.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, well let's go on to something serious then. How about we talk about the whole thing about eugenics, because to me, it's...
Hey, wait a second. Let's just clarify. What is eugenics?
Well, eugenics is the practice of sterilizing people so that you can prevent their bad genes from being passed to another generation.
Okay.
And, of course, you know, the whole thing is who decides what genes are good and what genes are bad? Well, you know, generally it's the government that gets to decide when you're talking about eugenics, although sometimes there's extra governmental bodies that are involved under the direction of the government or under the permission of the government. Anyways, I see the whole thing with tasers as being a kind of, you know, a really harsh form of eugenics. Eugenics is actually originated in the United States and was an inspiration to Nazi Germany, and Nazi Germany, before it began to kill people en masse, was actually had a really active eugenics program. And eugenics comes from a group of people. It's sort of like was promoted originally by a group of people that included the Bushes and the Rockefellers and all those guys. So.
And Janie Canuck.
Right. Her as well. Very good. I was going to get to that eventually. But Emily Murphy, who was famous for and did some really excellent work for the women's allowing women to vote and stuff. She did some great work there, but unfortunately, she was also a rabid prohibitionist
and racist.
I think it's a part of that whole thing where people who are introducing something new, in this case, women's rights, to a rather conservative forum, being the government, are expected in all other ways to be ultra conservative. although I'd have to say that in her case, she was quite enthusiastic about it and managed to write a series of polemics that ended up in marijuana being illegal all throughout the world. So, good work there, Janie Canuck.
You can see her face on every $50 bill now.
You can deface her face on.
Yeah.
it's weird. We all have our dark and our light, I guess, and that's definitely her dark side. Is that all that stuff about drugs and racism? And her, she was very paranoid that the Asians and the blacks were going to take over British Columbia and all this stuff. And she had this whole thing worked out. And
she had a racial purity aspect to her. She was a member of a Catholic secret society.
Well, and in fact, what she. She advocated that that immigrants who were busted for drug use all be sterilized, and it's kind of an interesting thing. Another person who advocated the same thing was Harry Lachlan, and Harry Lachlan was sort of like one of those people who was a really big promoter of eugenics in the United States and got all these different people on side. He promoted it as a scientific thing, you know. Geez, won't our society be better if we just sterilize all these, you know, these awful drug users and criminals and stuff. Well, it turns out that a lot of the people that were subject to this program were just normal people who were just poor. And what they would do is they would go into some really poor communities, and they would round up all the people who maybe couldn't afford education or just couldn't afford the time to send their kids to school because they had to have their kids, at home and working and stuff to keep, just to basically live. They would round up these kids and they would put them in homes and sterilize them. And one of the things that they did is they subjected them to a revelation that only came out a few years ago. They fed them radiation at one point, irradiated oats. In fact, this was Quaker oats that was responsible for this. And all they would tell them was that they were involved in some kind of a science study. And these kids would eat these oats, and then decades later, many of them were, of course, dying of cancers and stuff because they'd eaten this irradiated oats.
What country was this?
Well, this was the United States. So Mr. Lachlan, this is from his testimony before the House Committee on Immigration and Naturalization in 1920. And his big organization was the Eugenics Research Association, but he was also a consultant to many, many governmental bodies and testified before Congress on a number of different matters. You almost want to think of him as like the Harry Anslinger of eugenics, and Harry Anslinger was instrumental in creating the drug war in the United States, and he testified before the Congress and said all kinds of awful things just like Mr. Lachlan did. But he ended up, of course, just like Mr. Lachlan with an official title in an office and ran the whole thing. So here's what Mr. Lachlan has to say about eugenics. The character of the nation is determined primarily by its racial qualities, that is, by the hereditary physical, mental, and moral or temperamental traits of its people. And this could be an idea of the idea that, the basic idea behind eugenics. And he says, I made some studies for the Bureau of the Census, which show that it costs an average in round numbers of $1 an inmate a day to maintain our custodial cases, including those in insane asylums, schools for the feeble-minded, that's where they put all the poor people, schools for the deaf, poor houses, prisons, well, I guess they had some particular poor house for some of the other poor people. These were round figures for cost 3 or 4 years ago in 1916 when the data were accumulated. Now, in this one hospital alone, we have 1,300 and some odd patients and are expending on them $1 a day. We can get an idea of the magnitude of the cost to the state in a year on account of these aliens that might have been deported for the cost of 2 months' maintenance. And in particular, he's talking about immigrants here. So that from the standpoint simply of the outlay of dollars and cents, it would be more economical for the government to maintain a deportation service of considerable size and efficiency to scour the country, the prisons if there is no legal complications there, the hospitals for the insane, the institutions for the feeble-minded, all custodial institutions for socially inadequate folk, and to deport all aliens found in them. This was his idea back in 1920. The term socially inadequate includes the following classes: 1, feeble-minded; 2, insane; 3, criminalistic; 4, epileptic; 5, inebriate, including drug users; and 6, diseased.
What about 7, politicians?
7, blind, actually, unfortunately.
What, really?
8, deaf; 9, deformed; and 10, dependent, including children and old folks in homes, never-do-wells, tramps, and paupers.
What?
So basically what he was suggesting was that they go through all the different institutions that were available there at the time, and they find those people who were drug users or in any way maybe basically
I fit at least 5 of those.
People,
just
undesirables, basically. They were just going to say, yeah, Let's deport them. Now this brings to mind the case of a person.
Deport them to where?
Wherever, their original country.
Oh my God.
But doesn't this bring to mind the case, I don't know if you've been following this in the news at all or not, but there was a fellow here in Canada who was busted for cocaine use just a little while, a year or two ago. He fought his, I guess he, no, he pled guilty. And then he was, because of this now, he has been here since he was 1 year old. His parents came here and brought him from England. And he was a truck driver for some time. He had a period of depression. He did cocaine. He got busted. He pled guilty. And they shipped him back to England. He's been here, a landed immigrant, since he was 1 year old. Now, this mentality comes directly out of the whole eugenics movement. It's a part of the whole eugenics thing. Deport those drug users. Get them out of our gene pool. So just so we have some realization of where this mentality is coming from. But there's a lot more to it than that. The eugenics movement was even more focused on drug users. And in fact, it's a part of a movement that continues to this day. I feel like that to really get into this, it's a pretty...
So what about Canadian related stories of eugenics? Like what has gone on in Canada with regards to eugenics?
Well, you know, there's a couple of different things, like in Alberta and stuff, for until like 1970 or something, they were still doing eugenics, still sterilizing people that they considered to be mentally retarded. And so, you know, it's kind of a And that was actually quite a scandal. And in fact, you know, Alberta being this kind of like hotbed of conservatism, we shouldn't be too surprised that there are still to this day people who think that this is a good thing. In Alberta, it seems to be the major place for it.
Whoa.
So, I mean, you can get your fix of cattle conservatism and sterilization all at once there. Just a little trip to Alberta. But in the U.S., it's you know, this is basically where it got its start, is in the U.S. And isn't it interesting and kind of scary that the Bush family and the Rockefellers and all these really big movers and shakers who have been around for such a long time, influencing the progress of the United States, are for eugenics, have had connections with the Nazis, and also that eugenics became basically the founding philosophy of the whole Nazi movement to annihilate a good section of their population. But what's scary is that we're on the cusp again of doing this again. That it's making a big comeback.
And I would just like to throw in some of those reasons are: one, the Southern conservatism vote for George Bush and George Bush's dedication to those groups to institute changes within the Supreme Court and the laws in the states. To the recent election of the German Pope, who is also kind of more on the fundamentalist list, and also the rise of fundamentalism across the world. If we look at Germany, the reason they picked Prescott Bush, George Bush's grandfather, the reason they picked Adolf Hitler to be the war horse for their resource extraction and for their financial coverage in Germany and in Europe was because he had links to fundamentalist Christian groups. And so fundamentalism is almost a precursor to either Inquisition-style barbarism towards poor people and the disenfranchised, and or a precursor for war.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, but it's like, we're right on the cusp, and there are very, you know, there's a... I'm going to talk about this more later on, and it'll be a part of my my presentation at Theogenesis.
Okay.
But just the historical patterns and stuff are very important right now. What's going on? It points towards very particular things. In 2005, and what we're looking at right now, the White House is right now spending $23 million on state programs to screen primarily poor, Black, Asian, Hispanic, and Native American children for drug abuse. And the pharmaceutical lobby is preparing to prescribe very dangerous, known to cause suicidal thought drugs, antidepressants that are known to cause suicidal thoughts,
like Zoloft and those weird ones.
They're hoping to they're planning to replace pot and other substances with these drugs that are supposedly going to alleviate depression, but at the same time are actually going to cause suicide. So we know these things cause suicide. There's been studies that came out that show they cause suicide. There's a warning right now out that these things cause suicidal thoughts, even though supposedly they're antidepressants, and they're going to replace pot with these things. Does that make any sense at all? How many people are known to commit suicide because of pot?
None ever.
Anyway, so in January 2005, we got a wake-up call from former Libertarian Party President Ron Paul, who's now with the Republican Party. He blew the whistle on the U.S. government for funding a national mental health screening program under the White House's 2005 budget. The screening program was outlined in a 2003 report by the New Freedom Initiative, a federal committee that reports directly to the president. And what Congressman Paul had to say about this was that millions of kids were going to be forced to undergo psychiatric screening whether the parents consented or not. And this was his issue with it being a libertarian, was that the parents, if not the children, should have a right to consent or not consent to this type of screening. But, what Congressman Paul missed was some of the more troubling aspects of this funding. The New Freedom Initiative, for example, brazenly calls for government workers to be cross-trained to perform substance abuse screening at the same time they do mental health screening, lumping pot smokers into the same bag as the chronically depressed, schizophrenics, and sufferers of multiple personality disorder.
Oh, my God.
This proposed nationwide substance abuse screening program is going to attempt to bring race and class profiling to a new level. The New Freedom Initiative report asked government screeners to target supposedly high-risk populations and explicitly mentioned American Indians, Alaska Natives, African Americans, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, and Hispanic Americans, as well as people who are poor, uninsured, and homeless. Doesn't this remind you of eugenics?
Whoa, holy flashback.
And, meanwhile, the U.S. government's own statistics show that 72% of all illicit drug users are white. It's very interesting. The this
it's not interesting. It's downright scary.
Well, it's interestingly scary. It's scarily interesting. The British Medical Journal did pick up on this in a story back in June 2004 titled "Bush to Screen Everyone for Mental Illness." But again,
we did cover it on the radio show previously.
And we did. And what's interesting is that at the time we kind of missed the whole substance abuse thing, because although the British Medical Journal did say that every child in America was going to be screened for mental illness, we didn't know at the time that it was going to be mental illness and substance abuse.
It was embedded in the draft, but it was never came out as part of it.
It was hidden away in there. I wanted to know, you know, how far had they gotten on this? And nothing had been reported on it, except for Richard Cowan had made an excellent report sort of breaking the news that this actually was contained in the NFI, this whole thing about them wrapping the substance abuse angle in there. And although I found it separately, I had to give him kudos for being the only other journalist out there that discovered that. I want to know what had happened since then. That was back in 2004. So what I did is I took a look at the White House's 2005 budget, and I had a really difficult time deciphering all the different connections because, as you can imagine, it's quite convoluted. Eventually, I called former Libertarian Party President Ron Paul's office, and he directed me to White House staffers, and I got to talk to the Appropriations Committee. They told me that the White House's 2005 budget, in fact, they directed me to the appropriate page, contains $23,107,000 to accomplish the new Freedom Initiative goals of substance abuse screening the entire nation. And how this money is going to be spent has yet to be covered. Well, had yet to be covered by media anywhere before. I think my article is coming out in the latest issue. I think it's 56 of Cannabis Culture. If you want to read more on this, but it turns out that a lot of this stuff is going right into school substance abuse screening, of course, and in various places throughout the nation, and that this includes training to teach. Teachers and parents, how to identify children who are high so that they can be arrested and sent to heinous treatment centers that are infamous for their human rights abuses.
Boot style camps.
Homes for the drug-addled mind or something like that. Minds, right. Now, the thing about this is, again, this is all being cooked up by the Bush family, who once again were, you know, really strongly behind the eugenics movement originally, and it's very similar in so many respects to the eugenics movement that it just kind of blows the mind, you know. But back in the, if we take a look back into the early 1900s and at how drug use was was thought of by the people who founded the eugenics movement, we find that in fact Harry Lachlan, Harry Lachlan, the person who basically was behind the eugenics movement and one of the major populace of the movement, in his book Classification Standards, it's more of a pamphlet, but he did this thing called Classification Standards, which was intended to take a look at all the different people in state institutions and to classify them by their various traits so that they could then tell, you know, what predisposed people more to criminal behavior, and then they could go into the general population and look for people who also had those traits and then sterilize them, right? Well, they just made a list of traits up out of their mind, out of their own heads, from their own prejudices. They made a list, and there was no scientific aspect to this at all. These were the same prejudices that landed most of these people in prison in the first place. So they were sure to find what they were looking for, and when they went, they certainly did find it. Well, one of the things that was on this list that I don't think that anybody's caught this before, but it was something that I found in Classification Standards by Harry Lachlan, was hashish use. And this is 1922, and this is several years before marijuana was illegal in the States.
Oh, my God.
So they were using hashishis as an indicator of criminality before it was even illegal. So that meant what they were doing is they were going into the general population, and if they found somebody who was using hashish, they may be more likely to recommend that person for sterilization.
Now, the reason why that was because hashish has its origins from Eastern history as coming from the hashashin, or the word assassin. So the word assassin was associated with killing people, with murder, with crime. And so the use of hashish as an indicator came from the historical use of the word assassin, which comes from hashashin, had nothing to do with recorded a recorded increase in crime or murder or anything from the use of hashish, but merely from the root of the word hashish or hash.
Well, I think at this point there were a number of hashish dens throughout Europe. And throughout U.S. too, throughout the U.S. there were, so it was becoming like a more sort of popularized thing in the U.S. And there was even a book out, Confessions of a Hashish Eater or something like that.
Yeah.
And we can talk more about that another show. Well,
we covered it, remember?
Yeah, we did. Fitzhugh Ludlow. And then we even did an interview.
Yeah,
that was excellent. But at this point, you know, Fitzhugh Ludlow's work is out and people are like really interested in hash, and there's a bunch of hash dens. So let's jump forward to the future then. Let's jump forward to the future. The future from 1922 would be the present. So let's go to the present. Now, it's kind of funny that kind of funny in a sort of extremely scary way, that today the president is funding, the White House is funding with millions of dollars studies to discover, this is happening at the Roskamp Institute at the University of Florida, to discover why, or sorry, which genes are responsible for drug use.
Oh my God.
So, this has been going on for quite a few years now, and it's one of the most, and if you take a look at some of the information that's being put out by the U.S. government right now, this has been a steady focus for them since Bush has been in power. A steady focus for them to find which genes cause drug addiction or drug use. And it seems to me what they're doing is they're looking for people who are genetically predisposed. Now,
genetic scapegoats.
Yeah, and then they mention this over and over again until suddenly this whole thing with the New Freedom Initiative pops up, and then suddenly instead of mentioning their research into genetics and how they have to find out who's, you know, more likely to have these addictions, they just start mentioning this big long list of minorities, you know, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, blacks, all these people who, well, we all know, or at least, you know, we don't all know, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
who they think are, you know, are going to have more drug use. And it's the same
thing. Traditionally been racially profiled as being drug addicts.
Right. Despite the fact that the American government knows that more of the people who are on drugs are white.
Yeah.
It's shown by their own statistics. And so, you know, once again, it's the prejudices. More people who are black are in jail on drug charges right now in the U.S. than are white, even though there's more white users. So it's the prejudice that's landing these people in jail. And once again, it's the prejudice that is justifying the fact that we should be going, that they should be going after these people.
Wow.
and they're going to be using it, I believe, in the future as an excuse to apply these buzz killers that we were taught, that David Mama Levine's written an excellent article about that's available on the Cannabis Culture website. These basically anti-drug drugs that they can inject into your system that will block the effects of other substances, of euphoric substances.
We're going to interview David about that article for sure.
It's a great follow-up to this talk, and I almost feel like we should have had it on this show, but...
Okay, on an upcoming show. So we're going to break for a quick tune here. This is going out to the gentle sheep, and you know who you are. Yeah.
see your eyes, the look, your smile.